John, are you there? This is Dad's on the air.
Here.
Well, you are, mate. You're on the air. They're all listening to you, mate.
Well, welcome to Dad's on the air for Friday, February the
20th.
20th, Tuesday it is. Sorry.
Year of the
Pig. I've just got a parking ticket. I'm a bit rattled. The councils of this city long ago worked out they don't have to serve the customers anymore or the rate payers. All they have to do is fine people for parking. And, of course, there's nowhere to park, so they just persecute people. Talk about persecuting people. John Howard has worked out that he thinks it's a vote game to persecute separated fathers who are deemed to owe child support by the utterly despised and mismanaged child support agency. A press release yesterday from Matt Miller, the general manager of the child support agency, announced that the CSA was quadrupling its focus on separated fathers who deliberately minimise their income to cheat their way out of child support payments. Now, these are blokes who are perfectly capable and perfectly willing to look after their own kids who've arbitrarily had their kids ripped off them by the equally despised family court, and John Howard thinks there's votes to be gained by bashing them up.
They've also just acknowledged, the child support agency that is, that as many as 10,000 single mothers are understating their own incomes to fleece former partners of more than they are supposed to be paying for child support.
Oh, of course. That's absolutely standard practice, as anyone knows. And, you know, a lot of women understate their income, work for cash, get up to all sorts of nonsense, and they certainly do not spend this money on the children.
So are these the deadbeat mums?
Well, it just serves the government right for getting in the middle of separating couples and trying to work these things out. They should have stayed out of it. If John Howard had the slightest shred of integrity on this issue, he would have abolished the child support agency, as Tony Blair has done in Britain. It's an absolutely disastrous agency, and it has serious individual, social and financial consequences on many individuals and on society as a whole. It's an absolute fiasco. Nonetheless, Mr. Miller has said that some parents are minimising their income by hiding their income illegally, earning income in the cash economy and minimising their income through salary sacrificing for tax purposes. Now, for a start, salary sacrificing is an entirely legal thing which many people do, including the very wealthy in this country, for perfectly legitimate reasons. They don't see why their taxes should be wasted on a pack of bureaucrats like this running around persecuting them. He says these parents are not only cheating the child support system, they're cheating their children. Well, that is simply incorrect. These people, on the whole, are parents who have had their children arbitrarily ripped off them by an utterly corrupt court system, and they shouldn't be treated in this manner. They should not be financially and emotionally abused in this manner. He writes to combat this fraudulent activity. What about the fraudulent activity of all the child support agency officers who deem, that is, make up people's incomes on a daily basis? If they don't like the cut of your jib, which if you're male, they don't like the cut of your jib, they just basically make up your income or deem your income to be anything they damn well like. It is a disgraceful agency, and this government has done nothing to reform it. And they've had all these reports saying that the percentages are inequitable, that it doesn't work, that it's unfair, and yet they're continuing to persecute people in this manner. I think this will alienate a lot of people and alienate a lot of voters, and I don't know what John Howard is thinking he's doing. But Miller goes on to say that to combat this so-called fraudulent activity, the CSA is targeting parents who live in affluent suburbs but have reported minimum incomes to pay the minimum child support, and that's around $6 a week. CSA will also investigate parents who receive child support and who are suspected of reporting minimal incomes to receive higher payments from the partner and the Australian government. Mr. Miller said data matches from a variety of sources, such as bank statements and tax records, were a way to ensure compliance resources were targeted to where they are likely to uncover cheats. Big Brother is alive and well, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. It's shocking them, just marginalising people and victimising them. It's this us and them mentality, you know, that got us into two world wars in the 20th century that we should have grown out of by now and spewed over into the 21st century. And now we're victimising families, and the real victims, of course, are the children.
Of course, John, the people they're going after are the ones that are living in affluent suburbs and having enormous homes and everything and paying the minimum child support payments. However, they forget to say that probably those very same people have been ripped off by huge amounts.
People.
by their exes before at settlement time. And then, of course, like you said, the kids are removed on top of that. So if they've got a home left, they're very lucky. And if they're reluctant to pay...
And the lawyer's fees as well.
Yes.
Oh, yes, they've been ripped off sometimes for millions of dollars. Millions of dollars. Absolutely, totally ripped off. And I don't know why this government is continuing to support this disgraceful trade. On a more lighter note...
Yes.
We'll close on this story.
Truck going past. We heard that one.
We've heard dogs barking, trucks going by. Where are you, John?
In the thick of it, mate. What's going on there in the Bahamas?
In a taxi doing this spot for you. Steve Irwin, the portrait of Steve Irwin, has replaced Germaine Greer. You might remember Germaine Greer caused an absolute furor around the world when she attacked Steve Irwin shortly after his death, basically saying that the animal kingdom would be relieved. And the famous feminist Germaine Greer, you know, always ready to stir the pot, a sort of paid iconoclast, you could call her, stuck it into Steve Irwin, and Steve was regarded as one of the great Australians, one of the great fathers as well around the world. Now, in a neat twist, his portrait in the National Gallery has replaced the semi-nude portrait of Greer that was there. So she's out, he's in, and that's a nice bit of justice, I would think.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, mate, you have Warren Farrell on for the rest of the show, I think, or for some much of the rest of the show. He's one of the world's leading commentators on gender, as the audience might well know. He's written books such as Father and Child Reunion and The Myth of Male Power. He's a fantastic radio talent, far greater than any of us. He's a really brilliant speaker.
He's a star.
Brilliant intellect. The feminist lobby would like to paint him as some right-wing ideologue. In fact, he's an absolutely charming man. I've met him personally. He's a very charming man and a very, very mild-mannered man. And we thoroughly recommend his books. They're very well researched and well thought out. Father and Child Reunion, The Myth of Male Power, The Liberated Man, and quite a number of others. You can also look him up on his website, www.warrenfarrell.com.
Because they forget to say that he was one of them once, and that he used to fraternise with the enemy, I guess. 60 years ago, they would have said he was a fifth columnist.
Yes, indeed. All right, you guys have a great show.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. You have a good day, mate.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Okay, and that's Smiley off his album Belt Up. You're listening to Dad's on the Air, and we have Warren Farrell on the line, I believe. Good morning, Warren. Are you there?
Good morning, I am.
Welcome to Dad's on the Air. Great to have you on the show again for part two of the interview.
Very good. I'm looking forward to that, and hopefully we'll have no technological problems this time.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Right.
Of course, we're speaking to Warren Farrell, one of the leading social commentators of our time. And Warren, a few things we didn't discuss last time. We had so many questions of you, and we run out of time. What's your views on the family court system and how it operates? I don't know whether you're aware of our situation. We've just had some Band-Aid changes, but you're probably very familiar with the family court system as it operates generally.
Yes, unfortunately, I am. not from my own personal experience. I've never had a, but I've certainly been in court testifying on behalf, unfortunately, on behalf of fathers many times. I say unfortunately on behalf of fathers because if the family court systems were basically balanced, I would be, since my principle is that children, the research I did for father and child reunion revealed to me that all over the world, I found that children did after divorce do the best when they have about an equal amount of time with mothers and with fathers after divorce, and whether when those mothers and fathers live close to each other, and when there is no bad mouthing between that the children can overhear from mom to dad and dad to mom. So therefore, I would presumably be, if the court system was balanced, I would be called to court about equally by mothers and fathers to testify on behalf of having the parent that was not allowed to be involved with the children as much, to have that parent be involved with those children about 50% of the time. Unfortunately, though, it's been very rare that a mother has ever called me and said, I would like you to come to court to testify on behalf of my being involved with the children 50% of the time because my husband is preventing me from doing that, or the court is preventing me from doing that. A woman who wants to be involved with the children 50% of the time is almost never prevented from doing that by the court unless she has major things working against her, like psychological problems or abuse problems, or and very rarely does a father prevent or want to prevent a woman, a mother, from being involved half of the time in the court, with the children, rather.
One of the problems, of course, is that the fatherhood in general has been pushing for the presumption of equal shared parenting following parental separation. What is the main issue that the court has with the word equal sharing?
Well, it doesn't have any problem with equal parenting except when the mother objects to that. So if you ask most judges, do you believe the father and the mother should be involved equally with the children after divorce? Most judges would say, yeah, you know, either the mother could be involved a bit more or the mother and father should be involved about equally. Either one is fine with him or her. But the problem was that the mother says, I want to be the full-time mother and I believe I should be and I'm a better mother than the father is a father. Or I have more time for the children, or the father is not as good with the children as I am. Under any system, any protest on the part of the mother to that, then the judge has to sort of weigh the mother versus the father, and then psychologists are brought in to examine the mother and examine the father. And if they don't usually find any significant difference between the mother and the father, the judge usually has a bias in favor of the mother. Now, the judge would not say she or he has a bias in favor of the mother, but it happens in this type of way. Number one, the judge believes that if there's a conflict between the father and the mother, that then they will not be able to work very effectively after divorce, and so therefore the judge should choose one or the other. And then the judge goes to the next issue, which is, well, because divorce is destabilizing, we should have a stable situation for the child. Well, where has the father been? Where has the child lived previously, predominantly with the mother or with the father? And the answer is usually more likely to be that the mother has had more time with the child than the father has, and so therefore we'll go ahead and give the child to the mother to keep the child's situation stabilized. But the judge, and this is a mistake that judges make, and I say a mistake because research shows that when children of divorce do the best, they do best when there is an equal amount of time between the mother and the father, therefore that the real stability that the child seeks is the psychological stability of having both the mother and the father's input into its life, not the geographical stability of being involved more with one parent and then feeling abandoned by the other parent. The lack of involvement with the other parent makes the child often feel that it's lost its other parent or has a minimal amount, and so that works against the child, and that's what the judge does not know. And so the judge will often make the mistake of giving the child the parent custody that has had the dominant custody previously. Now, the exceptions to that rule is when the father has had the dominant custody previously, and then often still the judge finds a way of having the mother have custody predominantly afterwards. And so the real issue is that even though the judge claims not to have a bias in favor of the mother, one way or the other, the great majority of the time, no matter what the situation is, if the mother protests to equal parenting, usually the judge will rule, most judges will rule, in favor of the mother for a set of reasons that are oftentimes not held up when the situation is in reverse.
Well, that's the problem, of course, is that by giving the child to one or other of the parents, that puts the parent in a position where they have total control of their child, which ends up a lose-lose situation for the child and the father's or the non-custodial parent.
Yes, it ends up really a lose-lose situation for the child, the father, and the mother. Now, since the child, why it's a lose-lose situation for the child, I've already sort of mentioned, but that's only the beginning of that. I mean, when I say it's only the beginning of that, let me give a broader picture of how far the depth goes. We now have studies from all over the world that pretty much agree, despite varying methodologies and despite varying ideologies of the researchers, that children do best in children of divorce do better in 26 areas of measurement. Those areas of measurement are psychological, they're social, they're physical health, and they're academic. So all academic areas, especially math and science, the children do better in when they have an equal amount of time with mom and dad. They do much better socially, and psychologically. So, for example, children of divorce who have an equal amount of time with a father are much less likely to have temper tantrums. They're much less likely to feel like victims. They're less likely to be bullied or bully. They're less likely to have ADD or ADHD. They're less likely to, if they're a female, to be pregnant out of wedlock. They're less likely, if they're a male, to create a pregnancy out of wedlock. They're less likely to have drug problems. They're less likely to be disobedient. They're less likely to have drinking problems. They're less likely to have delinquency problems. So one nightmare after the other, when fathers are more involved, tends to be avoided, and one benefit after the other tends to be gained when the father has a significant amount of input. When I say benefit, what I mean, example of that is that children, the more the child of divorce has a lot of father input, the more likely that child is to be empathetic, and the more likely that child is to be assertive, not aggressive. And so that's really counterintuitive, because normally speaking, you would think of a child of divorce that mothers are more empathetic than fathers. So therefore, you would think that, as a rule, the child would have more empathy being absorbed by the mother. But what it turns out is that it does not create empathy, meaning that if a mother is very empathetic toward a child's every problem, what the child learns is that any time it does something wrong or does something that it needs help with, that the child is always there to support it. It learns how to receive empathy from the mother, but it doesn't learn how to give empathy from the mother. The way it learns how to give empathy is when, for example, the child and the father are wrestling, and the father says, you know, you can't if you kick me or poke me or pull my hair, I'm not going to continue this wrestling with you. And then the child continues that behavior, and the father says, okay, you kicked me, now I'm going to stop wrestling with you. I'll pick it up again tomorrow, but there'll be no more wrestling today. Now the child has just learned that as a result of tough love and boundaries being effectively enforced, the child has learned that it has to an incentive to think of the father's needs, not just its own needs. And so, therefore, and that's the beginning of empathy. It learns that thinking about others is for the winner. And whereas if the mother says, you know, I want you to think of my needs, and the child doesn't do it, and the mother says, and the mother just repeats herself repeatedly, which mothers will tend to do, then the child realizes that it can continue thinking only of its own needs. Usually it can wear down the mother's resistance, and therefore the child learns not to empathize, but that if it manipulates, it can get its own way.
And also if barriers are set for the child, that provides the child with security, because if the child knows that within a certain range of behaviors, it's not going to be punished, or it's not going to be ostracized or threatened with punishment, it knows that within those boundaries, it is safe to behave in whichever way it likes. Whereas if it has no boundaries, it effectively has no security. There's no limitation on its behavior.
That's correct. And that is also reinforced by its experience in the social world. So it goes to kindergarten or first grade. And if it's learned at home, you know, that when the brother hits sister, that sister can hit back, or brother can hit back when sister hits brother, and then it goes to school and it starts behaving the way that it learned it was perfectly fine at home that way in school, and it suddenly gets in trouble, its security is undermined. It doesn't know what it's learning at home does not work at school or in the social environment, and so it becomes very uncertain and insecure about itself there as well. And so you're getting a double level of security, the security of knowing that the freedom that to operate within a certain bounds at home, and then also the recognition that that behavior is working to be effective in the world outside of the home.
Sure. And if a father doesn't spend as much time with the child, the father-child relationship suffers, so that when they do actually get to spend time together, it's not as relaxed, it's more strained. You know, that they don't have the natural empathy that a father and a child would have from having spent time with each other and from just being used to being in each other's company. So therefore, you're also going to get the whole situation breaking down just because the father's possibly not used to being with the child so much. The child's not used to being with the father, so the father would feel inhibited in perhaps, you know, mapping out the boundaries that are in the child's best interests.
Yes, when a father and a mother are in a fight, or here's where the judge and the courts need to be a tough love with the parents. If the court is always saying which does the child want to be with, mother or father, then it's making the parents a prisoner of the child's approval. And a parent has to be free to be able to set good boundaries with the child, which means the child is often not going to approve of the parents. If the father is worrying about where the child wants to go and being a popular parent with the child, then the father cannot do what fathers do best. And in terms of contributing to the child, it can say, no, it's not okay. You can't go to you can't have just all sugar for breakfast and lunch and dinner. You can't go out to, you can't watch this violent movie. You can't beat the other kids up, because the child's going to say, well, I'm going to go to mommy's. And, you know, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Mommy, let me have candy. And then mom and dad get into competitive contests about giving the child more candy because they want to be more loved. That undermines the mother and it undermines the father, but it doubly undermines the father, because the father's contribution more frequently is one of good boundary enforcement with the child. Go ahead.
Of course, the problem is the way the court system is, They don't have any monitoring or contact compliance instrumentalities once the orders are given, and it's the father is often so easily eliminated out of the child's life, and this is one of the main objections.
Yet, despite court orders, the father is still excluded.
Yes,
yeah.
No matter how much you pay for obtaining court orders, and the judges say, "Well, I gave him the right to see his children," the custodial parent just says, "No, we're not abiding by those," and then that non-custodial parent is up for thousands more dollars to try and obtain compliance with the orders that he has.
Yes, that just means that money that should be spent on college education and supporting the child is being spent on court orders, and it also, you know, undermines, it tends to put, again, the parents in competitive positions. But let me describe a sort of more complex situation as to why the children need about an equal amount of time with their mom and dad. Whatever parent is the least, the one that sees the child the least, is the one that the child gets to know the least. And so as a child gets older, it looks in the mirror and sees its body language becoming the body language of whatever parent is absent, as well as whatever parent is with it. And so it begins to see that it is half the mom and half the dad. And so whenever one parent is minimally involved with the child in a non-intact family, in a divorced family, that parent appears to the child like a straw person. And therefore, that half of the child that is that parent that it sees very minimally becomes a straw person. So if there are bad things being said about that, the absent parent or the less involved parent, like he's less reliable or he doesn't really want to see you that much, or he's, he's sort of always arguing or whatever, that child, as it gets older, starts worrying that because it has the walk, the eyes, the hair, or whatever, the body language of the absent parent, that whatever is wrong with that absent parent or that minimally involved parent, that may also be a problem with the child as well. And so but the child doesn't have enough information to really process that well. So it becomes very insecure about the part of it that is that it doesn't really know very well. Secondly, the values of the less involved parent are values that cannot be very easily understood. That is, I'm sorry, the values of the parent that's minimally involved. This is the type of dynamic that occurs. Let's say the father goes, the child goes out and plays in the schoolyard. Now the mother would normally say, and goes and picks up a game and then gets beaten up during the game by one of the kids that it plays with. And the father's been home watching a rugby game or a soccer game or whatever. And then it's the end of visitation time, and so the child gets picked up by the mother and the child says, you know, well, I went to the playground and I got beaten up. And the child says, the mom says, well, what was dad doing? Well, I think he was home watching the game. And now the mother is totally convinced of two things. One is that dad cares more about the game than he cares about the child. And secondly, the child is, you know, is allowed, when the child's around the dad, to be doing things that are not safe and unprotected. So lack of caring and lack of safety. The mother is furious, and that justifies the mother's belief that it can that she can go ahead and ask for more time with the child, and that the father's a bad parent.
Yeah, or she can limit the amount of time that the child spends with the father.
That's right. It's part of the parental alienation syndrome, isn't it? What's your views on that, perhaps, Warren?
But let me just finish this.
Oh, sorry.
Because the real understanding comes with the conclusion of this, which is that what the mother doesn't understand and the father can't explain was that if the child had not been being picked up by the mother at that time, then the child would have done something like the following. It would have come home. It would have had been beaten up. There would have been some evidence of the child being beaten up. The child would have complained about the situation that happened at the schoolyard. And the child would have a chance to talk with the dad about what happened at the schoolyard. And the dad would say, well, what type of kid was that? And the boy would say, well, it was Bobby. And Bobby gets into fights with everybody. And, oh, okay, so you've observed that Bobby gets gets into fights with everybody. So in the future, what does that teach you? Where do you, you know, what do you have to do with Bobby? So you have to be, the child has learned, starts being, the processing with the dad is meant to teach the child how to be carefully observant of situations that are dangerous for it, as opposed to being prevented from ever being exposed to those situations to begin with.
Okay, so the child's developing responsibility in a way. It's learning to look after itself, as opposed
Correct.
To being mollycoddled in a safe situation where it never encounters risks.
Precisely, and so the father, the mistake that so many dads make is we don't explain that well to the mothers. And the mistake that the situation makes is that the mother, if she's picking up the child before the father has a chance to process that, the child and the father don't have a chance to really talk through, and the child doesn't have a chance to get the full learning experience of that. Secondly, it doesn't when the child tells the mother about that, it translates terribly. It just sounds like the father is being neglectful of the child. So unless the value system of the father is present with the child as frequently as the value system of the mother is present with the child, the child develops a sense that this is sort of the system, the value system of the parent that is less involved with the child becomes the minority value system that has less credibility. And that undermines the ability of that father to have a good check and balance with the tendency of mothers to overprotect. And the same is true in reverse. If the father is always pushing the child to try something new, it may endanger the child too much if the mother is not involved in the process to say, wait a minute, there's a time that you have to protect the child also.
Sure.
You have to give a child extra nurturance. That's why fathers and mothers work so, that's an example, one of a thousand, of why it's so important for a child of divorce to have the stability of the checks and balances of both the mother and the father. It's just like Australia needs the checks and balances of conservatives and liberals, that even though the liberals may hate the conservatives and the conservatives may hate the liberals, if you let either one run the country for too long, you have the problems that all
yes.
one-party systems end up with.
Well, the problem over here, of course, is that the Liberal Party is the Conservative Party. So,
yes, in the United States, both the Liberal and the Conservative parties are anti-fathers, so it really makes no difference which way you go.
So it's a bit of a hopeless situation. Well, we're talking with Dr. Warren Farrell. We'll just take a short break here, and we'll be back in a moment with more.
Dad's on the Air. And we're back with Dr. Warren Farrell, social commentator and author. Warren, the issue of child support, it's very big here, and it's even bigger in America, where I understand some of the states now put wanted posters on their websites and giving addresses and the amount of child support they owe. What's your views on that?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that again? Something was happening here, and I couldn't fully absorb the question.
Okay. The issue of child support, it's very big here, and it affects so many people adversely. And America, it's even worse, I understand. You jail people there. Some of the states now put wanted posters up on their websites with photos and addresses and the amount that non-custodial parents owe. What's your views on that behavior?
Well, I have no problem with people being child support being enforced. What I have a problem with is the unequal enforcement of child support, meaning that, for example, the great majority of fathers that raise children predominantly do so without even asking for child support. So we have to look at that. Why is it that a father can, the great majority of time, raise children without asking for child support, and a mother can't?
Well, a lot of those cases, because the father would be more affluent, because if he's gone to court and actually won custody of the child, he's been able to afford some fairly high-powered legal people to be on his team, and he tends to be more affluent, perhaps.
Yes, well, I'm talking about also with the father, even fathers that haven't gone to court, but in situations where, for example, situations where children have developmental disabilities, under those situations when they're very young, fathers are far more likely to be the caretaker of the children than the mothers are. And even in those cases where the child has developmental disabilities and the dad is working and the mother and father both agree, in a non-court battle situation for the father to be the primary caretaker, it's rare for the father to ask for or receive child support from the mother. But I have no problems with child support, and I have no—I mean, the parent that has the child least paying child support. However, what is a crime is when both parents want to be equally involved with the children, then that should occur, and then child support should be a non-issue.
Yes,
it should be an issue if, say, the mother is earning, can earn nothing, and has no option but to earn nothing, and she, let's say, is disabled or whatever, then child support is a reasonable issue. Or she has no education and no work history, then giving her 4 or 5 or 10 years to get an education and a work history and to begin to increasingly decrease the amount of child support that she's receiving, that's fair too. But under most circumstances, when the father and the mother have an equal amount of time with the children, there should be it's not a problem for children to be living with one parent under a slightly less advantaged position financially than the other parent, as long as it's not in the extreme, that it's a helpful thing for children to have the security of the mother, the security of the father, and to have different experiences of things being more available in one home and less available in the other home. Those can actually be positive contributions to a child's adaptability and life and growth.
Yes, so the problem, of course, is that, as we said earlier, the court does not accept the presumption of shared parenting as a starting point.
Yes, and so you have a double jeopardy here. One is, it first says, no, father, you cannot, the only option that you have is to pay more money and see the child less, and that's a lose-lose option. But the really problem starts, the deeper problem starts with the lack of time with the child to begin, I mean, that the father that wants equal time with the child can't get that, and then is paying not only child support but also money to the court system to fight for something that he should never have to fight for to begin with.
Absolutely.
And this is blatant, and the really major issue in both Australia and in the United States and Canada and in England, these are in blatant violation of our equal protection clause, or what we call in the United States the Equal Protection Clause, and in the United States is the 14th Amendment that you have the equivalent of in Australia as well. And so these are in major violations of that, and they really need to be challenged. I mean, what needs to happen, in my opinion, is that any judge that has a history of awarding children predominantly to a parent of one gender, to usually the mother, should be liable to being disbarred, and that should be that he is then proven, or she has proven herself or himself, to be a violator of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in the United States and your equivalent in Australia.
I think it also comes under Article 6 and I think 7 of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was passed by the United Nations. It comes under that as well, that you have a right to not be discriminated against by gender as well as race, colour, etc., etc. So it also comes under the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
And the Convention of the Rights of the Child.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then also in the United States, and I imagine you have an equivalent to this in Australia, there are privacy rights, rights of relationship rights that children have, that people have, and those the most important relationship rights is the right to not be deprived of relationships with your family, rights of association.
So the courts are in breach of these fundamental rights of children and parents, basically.
Yes. Now, let me make it really clear that, you know, what motivated me to do the research for Father and Child Reunion was, you know, I had been on the board of directors of the National Organization for Women in New York City, and I was very much in favor of equality and still am. But when the feminist movement came out in favor of children being more involved with their mothers, I said to myself, well, wait a minute, I don't want to just hold up equality as something that's inherently good for children if perhaps children are in fact better off with their mother. Maybe that's true. Maybe, and so let's not have a theory overcome a reality. And so the function of my research on Father and Child Reunion was to determine, was equality important for the children, or was in fact a mother better at raising children than a father? And what I discovered was that in fact, children that are raised most effectively after divorce are raised with an equal amount of mothering and fathering, and that if you can't have an equal amount of mothering and fathering, the next best option is for the child to be involved predominantly with, and this was the most surprising finding of Father and Child Reunion, the child does better involved predominantly with the father than it does involved predominantly with the mother, even when socioeconomic variables are controlled for.
An old hobby horse of mine is this whole issue of equality. I mean, equality is a mathematical fiction. Nothing actually equals anything else. Two rocks don't equal each other. Two horses don't equal each other. A man certainly does not equal a woman, and a mother does not equal a father. I mean, I think we really want to be striving more for a concept of balance rather than going for a mathematical fiction. In relationships, because as you said before, fathers and mothers both bring different things to the table. They are both equally important to the child, but it's a matter of establishing the balance between the mother and the father for the benefit of the child.
Yes, you know, in this case, equality and balance are really the same thing, meaning that when people use the word equality, they don't mean that men and women are the same. They only mean that that they should have equal opportunity. And in the case of children being involved with parents after divorce, what it turns out to be is that an equal amount of time with the mom and the dad is very valuable, because that equal amount of time creates a balance, and that balance creates a checks and balances, meaning that that mothers, as I was saying before, you know, the child that says to mom, you know, can I climb the tree, mom is more likely to say, well, sweetie, maybe in a few years from now, but right now the tree is very dangerous and you're too small. And dad is more likely to say, yes, go ahead and climb the tree, but be careful, and, you know, and then we'll watch the child for a while, but maybe get distracted by a cell phone. And if the child, worse comes to worse, and the child falls and breaks a bone, the father has said to himself on some level, well, you know, the child is having a learning experience by climbing that tree, and, you know, no big harm done, the bone will heal, and the child has learned to watch out for its own safety. Well, a father can go too far independent of the mother, and the mother can coddle the child out of ever having a good learning experience, but the father and the mother, when they're together, or when they're sort of having an equal amount of input to the child's lives, will oftentimes get into an argument that will appear to be negative, but in fact that argument is in some ways very positive, and that argument might go something like, no, you can't climb the tree, you're too young. The father says, let the child climb the tree. The mother says, if the child climbs the tree, the only way I'm okay with you climbing that tree is if you're out there in front of the tree, under the tree all the time, you don't have your cell phone, you're not preoccupied with that, and you don't ever leave under that tree, and also the child can't climb beyond this level. And the father and the mother negotiate, and what the child ends up with is the experience of climbing the tree that it wouldn't have with the mother, and the experience of protection that it might have had less of with the father. And so that combination really works out very, very well. And ideally, the mother and the, but if you have either parent, with the child with either parent 90% of the time or 80% of the time, the chances are fairly good that the other influence is less frequently available.
Warren, the tactics used by custodial parents to eliminate the child out of the lives of the non-custodial parents, false abuse allegations and parental alienation syndrome, do you have any views on those two issues that come up repeatedly?
Yes. Unfortunately, there's a whole dynamic that occurs. And after divorce, oftentimes, the mother... And this dynamic starts in childhood, and it goes something like this. Mothers, women, when they're younger, sort of, we put a lot more emphasis on women getting married and the importance of marriage. So you have, you know, when Princess Di got married, there were 2.2 billion people, about 90% women, watching that marriage with bated breath and biting nails on TV, and that was sort of their dream. And if you look at magazines for single women and married women, a lot of it is about relationship and marriage. And so when a marriage falls apart, oftentimes that dream of being swept away is being swept away. And so what men need to understand is that a divorce, even though most divorces are initiated by women, that oftentimes is the breach, it's the end of a dream that is socialized more deeply into the female psyche than it is into the male psyche.
Well, then, so why are women more likely to initiate a divorce? That would tend to go against the statistics, that would.
That would seem like that, but what happens is that dream has ended for the woman, and because she has expectations that aren't met. So part of that dream is that the man will, be loving and supportive and sensitive and caring and be a full-time breadwinner, and it has with it unrealistic expectations. He'll be a prince with a castle. And the average man is short a castle or two.
Sure. So do you think these expectations have become greater over time, say over the last 50 years with the divorce rate, you know, skyrocketing? Do you think, or in the old days, perhaps it was just the situation that it wasn't so easy to get a divorce, it wasn't socially acceptable, that women basically had to accept that their husband was a mere man, a mere mortal bloke, you know?
There was no option for a divorce in the old days, number one. So you were a team for life, for better or for worse. You were in the boat together. You made the best of it. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing, but it was what it was. But there's a deeper thing happening here, which was that the basic deal that nobody talked about in such crude terms as I'm going to do right now, or such basic terms as I'm going to do right now, was basically you always heard the mother always said to the daughter, and the father said to the daughter, do not have sex before marriage. Well, if you translate that into more basic terms, what the daughter was basically being told was, don't have sex before marriage, that is, do not have sex until a man offers you a lifetime of economic security, which meant in even more fundamental terms that one act of sex was worth a lifetime of economic security. And that was part of the dream of being swept away. Now, nobody worded it that way, but that's really what it amounted to, and that's why a prostitute was considered, you know, or a woman that was had sex before marriage was considered cheap, because she was giving something away cheaply that was supposed to buy for her a lifetime of economic security.
Sure, but a lot of the reason behind that is the birth control pill, which, you know, say in the 1930s or 40s, if a woman had sex, there was a reasonable chance that she was going to get pregnant, whereas these days they just chemically sterilize themselves, so that's not an issue.
That's precisely correct. And so the birth control pill, combined with societies being having enough luxury to be able to afford divorce, so you have divorce being permissible only in the more in societies that have enough economic independence to allow people to seek values that are more than survival based. So suddenly women, but mostly through the birth control pill, as you mentioned, women were suddenly free to be able to have no children if they didn't want to, or one or two children. And so there was freedom to do things, to end a marriage and to get a divorce. And so women often had expectations that weren't being met, were unhappy, were depressed, and then we're filing for divorce, and especially that's true if the divorces are only about 58% likely to be filed for by women if they don't have children, but if there is children, it goes up to over 65-70%.
That's amazing.
And then one of the reasons for that is that women know they will, with divorce, they will get not only they will not lose that much. They'll be able to keep the children. The man will have to pay child support, oftentimes alimony.
Sure.
They'll often have the home, and so after divorce,
and they can have sex without the stigma.
Right, today they can, previously they couldn't, and they can have divorce without the stigma. And so you put all that, so that after divorce, the man is still expected to provide services for the woman. He's still expected to provide money for the woman.
But he doesn't get his dinner cooked, and he doesn't get his bed made anymore.
No services are expected to be provided by the woman for the man, just the man for the woman. So the woman sees a better deal after divorce than the man does, and her expectations for marriage are often higher. You put the two, the permission is greater for divorce. You put the two of them together, and you have those options. But
We have the Family Law Act over here, which says no fault divorces. I'm sure you've got the equivalent statute over there, which has basically allowed open slather to divorce at your leisure.
Well, yes, I don't have a problem with no fault divorce. I have a problem with the after the divorce situation being one in which we give one sex all the services and the children, and the children are deprived of the father afterwards. The real issue is not fault or no fault divorce. The real issue is that, in my opinion, this is, the real issue is that nobody in marriage or in relationships understands how to communicate. The process of learning how to argue, debate, articulate our points of view are the ingredients for destroying love. Almost no one has an understanding of how to handle personal criticism and how to support your partner to give you personal criticism. And a lot of what I spend my life doing is doing couples communications workshops, where I teach people how to provide a safe environment for allowing their partner to say and share with them the things that are on their mind that are bothering them. But that takes a combination of Buddhist training, and it takes a combination of teaching people how to attach to their partner's story and really learning how to love their partner in a very different way. And if you train people to do those things better from an early age, people will want to stay married much longer. But to keep people married because you're forcing them to make the other person wrong, or you're forcing them to stay in a relationship forever that they may have made a mistake to stay in, without teaching them how to make their relationship more loving and supportive of each other, it's the latter that is the real need. That communication skills really need to be learned from preschool on, and almost every parent, every parent that I've ever met, needs to be taught how to communicate more effectively than they do.
Warren, we're just about out of time. Just to sum up, I'm sure we all agree on there's lots of changes need to be made, but how can we change the perception in the general community in order to bring about change and justice for our children and fathers?
The first thing is men need to do what women did, which is they need to read, learn, educate themselves, and then have the guts to speak up, have the guts to protest, have the guts to fight these things. So many men fight these, do not take an interest in men's issues or children being equally involved with both sexes until they're stuck in this type of situation. And then whatever happens to them happens to them. When the court finishes that process, they don't go back out and say, this is a larger social issue that I need to make sure my own children are not trapped in. We tend to get preoccupied with our own careers, our own families, and we don't put energy into saying something extremely damaging is happening here. And what is happening here that is damaging is that court systems are forcing hundreds of thousands of children to be deprived of their dad and to use money that should be used in their college educations to fight in court. Mothers are being deprived of the automatic understanding that if you are an abusive mother, by an abusive mother I mean a mother that presumes that you should have the children more than the father should, if you have that type of lack of maternal instinct, you will be rewarded by fighting for primary custody as opposed to punished by fighting for primary custody, that you don't have more right to your children than the husband does, except under exceptional circumstances.
Warren,
we have to protest.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. We'd like to thank you so much for joining us on the program today and sharing all your wisdom with us again. We've had no technical difficulties, so it was wonderful to have a great show.
Great having you on the show, Warren.
It was wonderful being on with both of you. You guys ask good questions and you listen extremely well.
Thank you. All right, well, we're going to have to sign off, I'm afraid. It's almost 12 o'clock here in Sydney. I think Dad's in the Air is just about ready to finish. Would you want to talk about next week's show, Peter?
Well, we've got an interesting show next week. I think we'll be talking about issues affecting the recent Justice Carmody's judgments.
Yep.
And also the Goulburn election issue.
Okay, thanks. With Dad's